I was reading through this book today, Curtains. I got all the way up to like with the last two chapters to go. I'll finish it tomorrow. It's just too entertaining and too interesting to put down. Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. Tom Jokinen writes about it, what it was like, you know, to work within kind of a family funeral business. And although it's in Canada, it's very much like what's happening here in the United States, including the changes in the way in which funerals are being done. And like weddings, like Facebook pages, people tend to make everything be exactly the way they want it to be. Tradition be damned. You know, it's all about self-expression. And we'll talk about that and how it's changed with funerals. Some of his experiences to be shared coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Ponet. So as an undertaker in training, Tom Jokinen works in the field of cremation as well as the pure undertaking because he's working for a guy who's sees the future. Although he comes from a long line of funeral directors, also sees the writing on the wall. And the writing on the wall is about cremations. That's how more and more people every year are handling the dead. And it makes not just financial sense for a lot of people, but also when you look at, you know, as cities are as compacted as they are, as Tom mentioned earlier, there's a certain necessity to finding a place for everybody. And so what was it like for you when you did your first cremation?
Oh, that was something. I mean, the first day I was there, they took me on a tour. The owner's son, who himself isn't an undertaker, but was working, as most kids do, you know, at dad's place of business off and on, showed me around, showed me where the arrangement room is, and showed me the two retorts, which is what they call the cremation ovens. Look like big Soviet era pizza ovens, floor to ceiling things. Pretty intimidating. Each one with a little porthole in its door so you can observe and watch what's going on and tend to your cremation. They were like these flaming evil eyes in the middle of a monster face. These are industrial machines, and but they're very efficient at what they do. The first cremation I was involved in, certainly I had to learn. It's not just like popping a cake in the oven. You have to deal with gas flow and airflow and tend to your cremation so that it's done cleanly and efficiently and without creating too much smoke, because frankly, nobody likes to see black smoke belching out of the chimney of a crematorium. It's just a little bit too much reality.
And although usually crematories are far away from population centers.
Yeah, they're usually on the outskirts. That's certainly the case in Winnipeg, where I worked, and I think the most zoning bylaws insist on them being away from the population, although there was the Neptune Society in California wanted to build a crematorium in industrial Richmond near San Francisco, and, you know, already a place where there's a lot of industrial output.
Yeah.
And the community said, no, we don't want it. We don't want a crematorium in our backyard. You know, we've got enough going on here. We don't want to be a factory of death. We don't want, which is, you know, they were talking about a very high volume crematorium. And the people of Richmond won their battle. The Neptune Society had to look elsewhere to build its crematorium.
But it's odd because it's not a factory of death, really. It actually helps to handle the death. And it, you know, the idea of crematories, I'm sure some people think of them as being unsanitary or unsavory or whatever. But I don't know. I think that's actually a really interesting point about putting them in an industrialized part of town where smoke is belching out anyway. I mean, you're already going to have the industries that are going to be there, this is the one that's probably going to be least hazardous to your health.
Well, there's what you're doing is you're burning organic matter. There's nothing toxic about it. There's certainly an argument that when you're looking at the baby boomer population, most of which have mercury fillings in their mouth, that you've got a certain amount of mercury going into the atmosphere as a result of cremation is a bit of a red herring. I mean, there hasn't been a ton of research, but industrial mercury is a big concern. Crematorium mercury is pretty small potatoes by comparison. But it ends up being a not in my backyard debate. You know, it's not dissimilar to when you want to set up anything that has connotations, negative, dark connotations to it in somebody's backyard, they're going to fight against it. But yeah, it is, for me, it's a startling experience to do it firsthand, but I can see the appeal. There's a certain romantic appeal to cremation, that there is a great tradition of humans taking their dead to the fire. Certainly Hindus, Sikhs have always done it. Ancient Romans did it. You know, there's a cleanliness to it. And yeah, what you end up with is a very sterile set of cremated remains, of mineral remains that you can scatter or bury or do all kinds of things with. And that is a huge opportunity for commerce. What to do with cremated remains? Well, all kinds of things, as it turns out.
I'll get back to that in a second with all the different urns and everything. I actually, at one point, I was writing some feature for a newspaper, and I was sort of brought on as kind of the intrepid feature guy, and I did a whole story about cremation and how it was growing in popularity, and I did a cremation. And I was talking with the guy who was running the crematory. This was 20 years ago, but he told me something interesting, that because you had mentioned several times about the Hindu tradition of the funeral pyre in your book. And what he told me was that in the modern translation, the oldest son hits the start button on the crematory. Is that what they were doing in Winnipeg too?
Not a big Hindu population in Winnipeg, but it, certainly the guy I worked with had that experience where, for religious reasons, the eldest son asked to be present at the beginning of the cremation so that he could press the start button, which is both a symbolic and literal equivalent of starting the outdoor funeral pyre, which is the tradition.
I thought that was very interesting.
Yeah, and, you know, we encouraged families to come back and be part of the beginning of the cremation. The way Neil Bardell, the undertaker I worked with, looked at it was putting the body in the retort was no different than putting the body in the ground, and people gather at the graveside to see a casket go into the ground. They shouldn't be nervous about seeing it go into the retort. It's exactly the same thing. It's the last disposition of the body.
Yeah, except that in this case, as an undertaker in training, you had to search for certain devices that were on the body to make sure that that didn't go in to the retort.
There is a routine, because most of the dead that we processed on any given day were very old people, and maybe that's gives you a sense of how it is. I can report through anecdotal evidence that most people are very old when they die. A lot of people have heart pacemakers or defibrillators, and part of the routine is to frisk them down and make sure that to see if they actually have one. It feels like about the size of a wooden matchbox under the skin and the chest. That has to come out before the body goes in to the retort, because those things will blow up. They won't blow up the building, but they'll do enough damage to the inside of the retort to require it to be fixed. Or if you happen to be peering in through the porthole to tend to the cremation, you know, it could injure the cremationist. So those things have to come out. You have to cut them out.
Yeah, and I'm going to read here from part of your book, Curtains, here, as you talk about. The goal is, in the end, to have a white powder. It's part of Neil's brand, the guy you work for, Neil's brand, having the whitest cremated remains in Winnipeg. What's this, I say, poking at a hard green glob the size of a pencil eraser. I don't know, but every cremation, we get one or two. And without evidence to the contrary, right, I decide it must be the soul. Tell me about that little green glob. What was it, really any idea what that is? That pops
well,
up?
You know, the process of the sort, not every funeral home or crematorium does it, but Neil decided that, yeah, this was important to his brand, because part of the thing that he was encouraging people to do is if they didn't have an idea of what to do with the cremated remains, he maintained a rose garden, a scattering garden out the front. And his theory was, backed up by plant scientists, although it's not without its dispute, that the human cremated remains are good for growing plants like roses. And so he wanted them pure, and he thought it was an aesthetic issue too. Nobody likes gray cremated remains. I myself thought, I'm not sure people have really strong opinions about the color of their cremated remains, but I'll go along with this.
Right.
The point of the hand sort is you're taking out that which is not human and processing that which is. And some people have artificial hips or knees. You know, we pass a big heavy magnet through the remains as we set them to cool on a big steel table to pull out, you know, staples from the casket or screws or surgical implants, surgical staples, zippers from the clothing, buttons, all that. Bits of stone from the retort wall. I always found these little green things hard, almost like plastic. And I asked the cremationist who'd been doing this for 20 years what it was, and he just shrugged. I don't know, but we get them all the time. And sure enough, they did. So that's the conclusion I came to.
That it's the soul.
It's the soul. Because nobody had a decent explanation for where that stuff comes from. We'd love to hear from somebody if they know.
Either that or the alien implant theory. So I'll.
Oh, you know what? Maybe. Yeah, I hadn't thought of that either. If that's the case, then everybody has one.
Everybody's got
one. There's the confirmation of what we all knew all along.
We're talking with Tom Jokinen, the author of Curtains. So these cremations, they're growing in popularity. We see some countries in Europe, for example, and I think this is very interesting, where a body is only put into the ground on a lease basis now because of the space that is like 15-year lease on a grave.
Yeah, this is a kind of a difference of opinion between Europe and America, North America, on what to do with a body and what counts as permanence. Because in Europe, where land is at a premium, when you buy a grave, you're buying it, you're leasing it for about 15 years. So after 15 years, your family would have the option of rebuying the space, or else the body or the remains by this point will be no different than what you get in a cremation after 15 years, be just the bones, to be disinterred and then placed in a communal columbarium or a charnel house or a scattering garden, you know, and the land would be reused for another grave. It's an interesting approach. First, it says that nothing is permanent, and this idea that the grave that you buy will be there forever and ever and ever is, at this point, a very American idea, and one which is giving cemeteries a certain amount of problem. You know, they're dealing with the fact that most people will attend to a grave of a loved one for the first 2 or 2.5 years after someone dies, and then never again. And so you've got all this cemetery property where nobody goes anymore. And this, unfortunately, has tempted some cemetery owners to resell property when the law states very clearly they're not supposed to do that. Right. You've got cases where bodies, remains are disinterred and graves are resold. And when somebody does that in the States or in Canada, they're going to jail for that. Whereas in Europe, that's the normal practice.
It's totally and understandable in one sense, but at the same time, it reflects our kind of our changing values on that. They didn't used to do that. Now that I think about it, it kind of depends what country you're in Europe may have done that at one time. But you know, in the future of our North American burial practices, where do you see it going based on your experiences as an undertaker in training?
Two ways. Certainly, it's hard to overstate the impact of cremation. It's just rising and rising. It's the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution or the invention of the steam engine. It is socially acceptable, and in some cases acceptable. The Catholic Church lifted its ban on cremation way back in Vatican II, and just recently, in the last 2 years, has told the flock that if they want to scatter cremated remains, they can go ahead and do so, and it won't counter their faith, which is quite a development, because the church has always said they prefer cremation or otherwise for the body to stay together in a cemetery.
Well, they always said that the belief was that it still is. It's okay as long as you are not cremating the body out of a belief that there is no resurrection of the body.
Right.
And so
you're not doing it to thumb your nose at the church.
Right. As long as you're not
doing it as a choice.
There you go.
Yeah. Because they were stuck with the fact that, you know, you're telling parishioners that there's only one way to do things, and that's to bury the body. And so what you're doing is guaranteeing that everybody who worships at a Catholic church is paying the highest price available to have that body buried. You know, you got to buy a casket, you got to buy a vault, you got to buy a plot in the Catholic cemetery. And it's just untenable. This gives people the opportunity to express themselves differently without feeling they're going against their faith.
And save money at the same time. I mean, I remember when I had my father cremated, and I eschewed the idea of getting one of these $1,000 urns. We found an appropriate place for him. But when I got his ashes, I remember getting it from the local cremation society in essentially amounted to like a cigar box.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little more elegant than that, but that's what it was. And it was very inexpensive. And I think that was the way my dad would have wanted, absolutely wanted it.
Well,
just not to spend huge amounts of money on him on the way out. That's what he wanted.
Well, money is a big question. And the way Neil Bardell, who I worked with, put it, you know, you can buy a $600 urn if you want. We sell them. Have you got something at home that has meaning, like a tackle box?
Right.
Or a jewelry box, or even a Folger's coffee tin that he kept his tools in the tool shed, right? Stuff that actually has some meaning rather than a manufactured product which is outrageously highly priced.
Well, and you were talking about the urns. Some of these urns now are back up to what caskets were.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you're paying thousands of dollars for an urn, and although at least with an urn, you get to see it. At least that's true, that unlike a casket where you either buried it or burned it, you never saw it again. At least if you spent that kind of money, you'd theoretically have it on the mantle.
Yeah, unless you're putting it in a columbarium, which is the equivalent of burying, or putting in a mausoleum. And plenty of people bury urns. Plenty of people bury urns in an urn vault, which is when it gets a little bit even more strange.
Right.
So you're digging a hole for cremated remains, which, you know, you may think naturally belong free and into the earth. You're putting it in a small concrete vault or plastic vault inside an urn, protecting it from, I don't know, the elements, I guess. But
Well, for the same that same theory of buying the concrete vaults and then putting a steel casket with the remains in it,
yes,
you know, to protect it from what? You were putting it in the ground. And I know that people have this sort of feeling that that this is how we express love, that this is the best way to show love.
Yeah.
And I'm always glad if somebody doesn't have that feeling, that they let their family know that they don't have to express it that way. Well, I think we handled that first thought about what the future of funeral practices is going to be. Let's find out what number two is coming up in just a second. Tom Jokin in the book is Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. And I want to read you a part here, too. Which I think is a real conversation starter about ritual and how ritual has changed and is changing. I mean, it's not just how the physical handling of the body has changed, but the decentralization of religion when it comes to honoring the dead and all of the new different ways that that's happening. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. So at one time, churches worked hand in hand with funeral directors to kind of one hand washing the other kind of a situation where there was a system where families were fed down a kind of conveyor belt. That system has changed. And in fact, the church and the funeral industry is trying to change with it. We're talking about that in the book, Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. Tom Jokinen was an undertaker in training for long enough to come up with some very interesting insights in the future of the industry. And we'll talk about that and how it may be affecting you, some of the things you may be deciding on that just wasn't an option, even as recent as 10 years ago. Coming up next on Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. Tom Jokinen from the CVC. You're back to working in radio, Tom?
Just doing some freelance. I was working there full-time on staff, but I gave that up to do this crazy gig at a funeral home. So, no, not permanently.
The book, Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. So I think you were just coming up to what you thought the other road was for our future of our funereal practices.
Cremation.
Cremation, yeah.
Yeah, what cremation does is it liberates you from having to deal with this body and deal with the profession that is equipped to deal with the body for you. Now, the way they put it is, you can pull out your own teeth, but most people go to a dentist. You can deal with the dead yourself. There's no law against it, but most people prefer to hire an undertaker. What cremation does is it deals with the body and presents to you the remains, which open up an omnivore's dilemma of possibilities. You can bury cremated remains. You can scatter them in a place that has meaning. You can put them in an urn and put them on your shelf.
Right.
You can have jewelry made from cremated remains.
Right.
You can have
diamonds.
Them packed into fireworks and fire them off. You can... Right. Pack them into shotgun shells and take the deceased for one last hunting trip. There are art urns available that are one-of-a-kind creations by artists who work strictly in the medium of funerary objects. Some are whimsical and funny. I saw one that looks like a big giant cigar stubbed upside down that operates as a humidor when it's not being used as a funeral receptacle. So you can keep your cigars in it in life and then put yourself in it in death. Certainly one of my, the one that really caught my attention was the so-called huggable urn, which is a plush teddy bear. He's got a little zipper in his back and enough room inside that you can put the requisite 200 cubic inches of cremated remains and zip him back up and put him on a shelf or let the kids play with him. He is a huggable urn, a plush teddy bear. This tells me that the funeral ritual has gone to places it's never been before.
What about in Canada, or for that matter, North America? How about the rise of more exotic methods like cryogenics or the wildlife return of the body, putting the body back into nature and having it decompose naturally and eventually eaten by, wolves?
Well, it's a very organic, and I find people are innately drawn to the idea of what they call green burial. If you saw the series 6 Feet Under, that's the hero of the show, Nate. That's how he goes out. The family carries him to a burial ground, which is in a forest and not a traditional cemetery. In a shroud and not in a casket, he's buried. People. The family fills the hole with sand by hand, and a rock and a tree is placed to mark the spot. Not a tombstone. It has both the illusion and the romance of literal back to earth. And when I talk to people about it, you can see the eyebrows pick up, and they say that sounds oddly appealing. The problem is availability. There are a few green burial cemeteries in the United States, but not many. There's one in the works in Canada, possibly two, one on the West Coast and one in Guelph, Ontario, but it's a long way away yet. So it's still at the idea phase. Now, that's once again common in Europe. In the UK, about 10% of all the dead are buried in burial forests. You know, there's been a number of farmers who have their approach to dealing with a dwindling economy is to turn farmland into burial land. So they've established green cemeteries in the UK. It's not uncommon there, but it's still a growth industry in the U.S. and Canada hasn't quite hit there yet. But there are other methods too. You know, there are some technologies that are poised to replace cremation, that are arguably more ecologically friendly. I mean, cremation seems like a very clean and efficient way to deal with the body. You're not necessarily using embalming chemicals and burying a big casket and vault and taking up real estate. But there's a lot of fossil fuel that gets burned up. Every cremation is about the equivalent of an 800-kilometer car ride. So if you're really concerned about leaving an ecological footprint, you might raise a question about cremation. Now, there's a process called resomation, which is basically a dissolving of the organic part of the body, the flesh, through alkaline hydrolysis, a kind of a chemical reaction. The body is placed in a bath of alkaline and is dissolved, leaving clean white bones, the same process of cremation, but without using the fire. Now, if you can get past the ick factor there,
right?
I know that there are a couple of funeral homes in Canada that are looking into resomation. I've talked to funeral directors who say, you know what, it's still cost prohibitive. It's never, and plus it's socially, it's never going to catch on. We'll see.
It very much reminds me of what Jeffrey Dahmer was doing.
Oh, dear. See, this is what I'm talking about,
yeah,
right?
But it was.
It doesn't have that romantic notion of clarity, cleansing through fire. No, not if you're bringing up Jeffrey Dahmer.
Yeah, but I mean, it's a little bit like getting sheep dipped or something. It sort of seems like, you know, it doesn't, I get it. And I think that's an interesting possibility, but I could see why that one might be harder to catch on at this point.
Yeah, I'm interested to hear discussions with potential investors on how to market this. There's also a process called promession, which is being piloted in Sweden, which is a freeze-drying of the body, the way you would freeze-dry food for a camping trip or you know, to send up with astronauts. Then the freeze-dried body is shaken down into a kind of pink powder that, like cremated remains, can be buried or scattered and is organic enough that it acts as a natural fertilizer. So,
yeah. But what if you got it
again? You're not using the fossil fuels, and then you're in the afterlife, you're working as a fertilizer.
But, which I like that, but I mean, what if you got that freeze-dried stuff wet?
Well, it's going to happen if you put it in the ground, for sure.
But I mean, in your hand, wouldn't it get all globby? Wouldn't it get
I've
all
never
like?
Experienced that.
I mean, I've had a few MRIs which were freeze dried, and then we added hot water to it, it sort of reanimated a little bit.
It's not very appealing, is it?
Well, I mean, it's an interesting idea. I mean, for that matter, why not? You know, take the body and put it in liquid hydrogen, and then just, you know, crack it, just make, you know, shatter it into like the metallic guy in Terminator 2 or something like that.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned cryonics. I mean, this is what is happening to hundreds of clients of cryonics institutes in the U.S. Being put on ice, and they're doing all kinds of experiments. Unfortunately, the problem that they found was when you freeze a body, using liquid nitrogen, that liquid or ice crystals form, and when it comes time to thaw the body, those ice crystals have done a great deal of damage. If you know that any food that you eat that's been frozen is just not the same consistency of fresh food. Ice crystals form and kind of degrade the cell walls, and then things get a little sloppy and loose. They're now experimenting with what they call vitrification, which is instead of freezing the body into an ice crystal solid, it is more like a glass, which is technically a liquid, a very slow moving liquid, but you're not getting crystallization and damage to the body. So this is the latest development in cryonics. It just means that those who have been cryonically preserved, you know, the first round, the people in the late 60s and 70s, there's a bit more question of whether if miracles happen hundreds of years from now and people can be revived from cryonics, that those first the first round of folks who were frozen might be lost.
Well, I was thinking about that would be a good idea. And then I saw the movie Idiocracy. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but that'll put you off cryogenics right there. You won't want to come back 200 years, 300 years into the future. So the book is Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. We'll talk with Tom Jokinen coming up next hour with your questions and comments. But while I've got you here, let's talk just one moment about, you mentioned how much energy it took to dispose of one person in the crematory, but there was that story you tell of a 600-pound man that had to be cremated, and that almost like turned into an ecological disaster. It seemed like it was teetering on the brink of being the China syndrome or something. We're going to see Three Mile Island meltdown. Talk about that.
Well, you know, this is a current reality. People are getting bigger and bigger, and they die, and they have to be buried or cremated. I certainly know of. There's a couple of companies that produce caskets, oversized caskets for really large folks. And when it comes to cremation, there are limits to what standard retorts can handle. This fellow that we cremated was probably about 500, 600 pounds, and the family were not in a position to buy a customized oversized casket. So the funeral director from a small town in Manitoba, excuse me, built one himself, which I thought was an amazing gesture. You know, he didn't even charge for it. He took some pine wood and in his workshop created this oversized box with yellow rope handles so that the body could be delivered to the crematorium with some dignity. But believe me, opening that back door of the hearse and seeing that box that he made and thinking there's a body in there, this thing was, floor of the casket to the roof of the or floor of the hearse to the roof, and just as wide, that was a big box. When it comes time to cremating, of course, you're talking about an immense amount of stored energy in fat. And the guy I worked with who has years of experience at this basically kept a fire extinguisher handy because he didn't know where it was going to go. And I found myself moving closer and closer and closer to the back door of the crematorium as the temperature rose and we could actually start to see fire lipping out underneath the door of the retorts, you know, the big sliding door.
Right.
I stood out in the parking lot and watched. It was at nighttime. We did this cremation at nighttime, and I could see through the chimney coming out of the crematorium this amazing light show. Sparks and blue flames as you would get out of a jet engine, and it was both startling and oddly beautiful. It was as if this guy was giving off a second life in flames and sparks. Had us a little bit nervous that the whole door might get blown off, but in the end, things were under control, and it was quite something.
You know, I had worked at some point at a radio station in the what we call the Quad Cities here in the Midwest, so Davenport, Iowa, and a couple other cities and small cities. But a radio station I worked for there was built into a former funeral home. The funeral home had moved, like so often you write about, had moved onto the increasing outskirts of town.
Right.
And this radio station had bought this beautiful old mansion, which had been the original radio station complex, or original funeral complex turned into a radio station, and it was beset with ghosts.
Oh.
and I'm really serious. There were so many people that had a ghost experience in that building. Was there any tradition of that in the funeral business? Are there people that talk about that or their unusual experiences with the dead in that way?
You know, I think it probably has to do with receptivity, personal receptivity. I have a background in science, is what I studied. My ex, you know, biochemistry and physiology. I went to medical school for a couple of years in the 80s. My first exposure to the dead was through dissection of a body. A very clinical experience. What I found dealing with the dead in a funeral home was a lot. It was very different. I mean, it wasn't so clinical. These are people that had names and stories. You know, we'd read about them in the obituaries, get to learn the names of their children and the fact that they had dreams and jobs and hobbies and, you know, learn the name of their pets, for goodness sake. They were very human. But I think I was somehow inclined to, as a defense mechanism, to think more clinically of the dead. And I know that there are some people that are more receptive to other strange impressions,
well,
histories.
I certainly
worked with a guy.
Yeah, I was going to say, did it come up with other people there?
Yeah, I certainly worked with a guy who was the weekend cremationist. He was a retired gentleman. He also taught waste management at Red River College during the week to engineers. But he wasn't an undertaker. He just operated the crematorium on weekends. And he told me that there was an experience he had with a young man whose body had been brought to the crematorium, a suicide. And as he was, getting him ready for cremation, he said out loud, the man who worked there said out loud, that was a really stupid thing to do, putting your family through that. And as he turned around, he felt two hands push him from behind. And of course, he was the only man and the only person in the building. But he had that experience. And it was a reminder to him that there are things we don't understand, and that a certain amount of respect and awe for the dead is called for, and it's something to never forget. And it was his own hubris and his own arrogance that caused him to say to a complete stranger that he'd made a fool of himself by committing suicide. He was answered quite quickly. And he believes that that happened. And I didn't experience that sort of thing myself, but it's impossible to work in that environment without having the hair in the back of your neck get raised from time to time.
From time to time. You know, you did write about something, and I meant to get back to it earlier, and so I'll also put on hold a discussion about religious practices for the next hour when we take some calls. But I thought what was interesting as you were reflecting in the book about what this was like for you as an undertaker in training, and that you were seeing all of these indignities, in a way, I mean, necessary indignities, but the idea of putting, you know, fluid and, you know, chemicals into people's body to pink up their skin so that they looked natural. And then there was an actual toilet that was underneath the table where the embalming was taking place, right? That the blood would be drained right into the sewer system,
right?
And that you said, you know, it's interesting as you were reflecting on that, that then the debate about dignity would come down to whether or not they were dressed they were dressed in normal clothes, or whether did they get clothes that were split up the back. And
right.
I thought that showed this kind of selective consciousness, you know, that you become sort of, you kind of close off all of these other things that are happening to the body. And then on this other thing about dressing, well, that was about dignity for the dead. And I thought, wow, that, I can't really sort that out, but it sure made for an interesting discussion in the book, Curtains, Adventures of an Undertaker in Training. So we'll get back to that. Your questions, your comments, your experiences. Maybe you too worked as a funeral director for a while, or were in that business, like my friend Killer Bees, who's a comedian, who was actually went to, I don't know if he graduated, I think he did, to the with the John A. Gupton School of Funeral Sciences, I think it was in Nashville, because he gave me a trocar button once, and I had it on my desk for many years. And there's a lot of you out there. Plus, your questions about the future of funeral practices next with Tom Jokinen, author of Curtains on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett.